Start a story with Once Upon a Time and you're sure to grab people's attention. Many of us have been read fairy tales as children at bedtime by our parents. Being read these stories has a magical hold over us. But before stories like Puss in Boots and Bluebeard were written, they were passed on through oral storytelling. Or were they? Ruth Bottigheimer doesn't think so. She believes print has played a much more prominent role in fairy tale history. But her position has been challenged by folklorists. To find out why fairy tale scholars are huffing and puffing, we're joined by Ruth Bottigheimer, who joins us from Stony Brook in New York State, where she teaches fairy tales at the Stony Brook University. She's just published her thoughts in Fairy Tales, A New History. Welcome to the book show, Ruth.
Thanks very much. It's nice to be here.
And representing, I suppose, the other side is Dan Ben-Amos. He's the chair of the graduate program in folklore and folklife and a professor in the Department of Near Eastern Languages and Civilizations at the University of Pennsylvania. Welcome to the book show, Ben. Dan.
Thank you.
Well, Dan, can we start with you first? Dan Ben-Amos, what's been the standard explanation for the generation and transmission of fairy tales?
I don't know it is just an explanation. This is an observation of social behavior and artistic performance. And the observation is that people tell stories orally to one another. And this type of narration exists in non-literate societies, and it continued to exist in literate societies, where literacy began to develop, but at the same time it continued to be part of the oral entertainment and social entertainment of telling stories. People are telling stories to each other, and this observation is the basis for the study of folklore, and this is for the many interpretations of oral tradition and oral storytelling.
Okay. Well, Ruth, you disagree with the explanations of the origins of particularly rags-to-riches fairy tales. Give us an example of this type of story.
The most famous example is Puss in Boots, in which a very poor boy, through magic, that is, his cat is a fairy, and I'm talking now about the Renaissance version of this, that Straparola wrote. Through magic, he marries a princess and then becomes wealthy. And that's pretty generally the outline for a Rye's fairy tale. A poor hero or heroine who, through magic, marries a prince or princess and never has another care.
So Cinderella would fit into this one as well.
Mm-hmm. Cinderella is a problematical one. Cinderella, the way people tell it now, is certainly a rags-to-riches tale. But it's very interesting because the first example we have of Cinderella is from Basile's Pantamerone in the early 1600s, and there she was the daughter of a prince. So it's not really a rise tale so much as it is a restoration to her royal estate that takes place. But yes, I mean, most people think of Cinderella as a rags-to-riches tale because that's the way it's been told primarily since the 19th century.
So you mentioned Straparola, and he's very important to your theory. Who was he?
Absolutely.
Tell me about him first. Who was he?
We really don't know very much about him as an individual. We can surmise a lot about him because a lot is known about professional writers in the 1500s. But about Straparola, we know that he was born in the town of Caravaggio, that he left sometime in late adolescence, early manhood, and went to Venice, and published some poems twice, actually. And the same volume with a few additions. And then he disappears from the early 1500s to 1551, when all of a sudden he's back center stage publishing a collection of tales, most of which he's taken from other tale collections that already were in print. But there are a couple of handfuls of tales that are new, and among these are the Rise fairy tales.
Okay, so you're saying that the Rise fairy tales, like Puss in Boots and the problematic Cinderella perhaps, were inventions of his mind.
I am saying that, and I'm saying that because I find no examples of this kind of tale before Straparola. Now, I'm pretty sure Dan has got something to say about that, but let me say first that the Rise fairy tales in Straparola are tales about people in the lives they lived, and sort of secular tales. And we're in Renaissance Italy just at this point. Things change, the world changed, people's feelings about themselves changed. And this new kind of story, centering on people as opposed to, say, God, comes into existence. And the plot is what is completely new about it.
Well, let's talk to Dan Ben Amos. Dan, you disagree with this theory of the origins of the Rise tale, for example, Puss in Boots. Why?
Because the evidence shows me that such tales existed before Straparola, and they were part of oral tradition and part even of written tradition. Let's say I don't need to go any farther than the Bible, the Old Testament, where David killed Goliath, and out of becoming a shepherd, became afterwards a king. Married the daughter of a king and himself became a king. And in terms of the biblical perception, his killing of Goliath was at the help of a supernatural force. He didn't do it by himself. It was by God, with the help of God. And then, of course, we can sort of skip or move forward, and we find tales of that sort both in Greece, late antiquities, the 3rd century. We can find tales of that sort in the writing of Claudius Aelianus, and there is a heroine by the name of Aspasia, who was a miserable, ugly-looking young girl who, with the help of magic, got to rise out of her miserable situation. And lastly, and this is Ruth knows about it because we have been in touch about it, a tale from the 13th century in Europe, that is available to us in Hebrew, about a young man that was dropped at the tower or quarters of a princess that was secluded, and both of them fell in love, and then he became also got out of his miserable situation and lived a quite wealthy life. So this type of tales, both with the magic part of it, existed before Straparola. I don't have all the tales about that involve these particular patterns, but this particular pattern is hardly new to the 16th century of Italy.
And in your research into Jewish folklore, I believe you found the Cinderella story elsewhere, or a motive about a shoe or a slipper.
Well, the Cinderella story, as Ruth said, is a very complex one. It is not just in terms of Jewish material. Say, what we have in case of the Jewish material, and this is very interesting, we find that both in Yemen, among Yemenite Jews, and among Moroccan Jews, there are versions that are which are similar to the versions that are being taught, that were recorded or written by Basile in Italy in the 17th century, a pattern in which Cinderella is not necessarily rich or poor, but she instigates the murder of her own mother at the suggestions of a neighbor, and then recommends the pressures her father to marry this neighbor, and then got suffers from a stepmother, and then the whole story follows the pattern that we know later.
So she deserves it.
Well, I don't know whether she didn't deserve to be the princess afterwards. Because
no, I mean she deserves to suffer a bit because she was such a bad daughter.
She was certainly a bad daughter.
So how do you think these stories land in Straparola's lap in Venice in the 16th century? Do you think they're generally known?
No, this is not. This particular story did not land in Straparola's lap. It landed in Basile's lap 100 years after, or about 100 years, 80 years after Straparola. How did it land in his lap? Through oral tradition.
Okay, well, Ruth, why are you not persuaded by this evidence?
There's tons of reasons, but let me start out with something that Dan said early on. He says people tell stories to one another, and this has been observed. Let's put this in historical context. It has been observed in the 19th and 20th centuries. The fact that people tell stories has been observed earlier, but they were never observed telling wise fairy tales. That's something that happened only observed in the 19th and 20th century. But from that,
are you sure? I mean, do you mean observed or do you mean written about? Because how can you say what's being observed if it's not being written about?
Right. Okay. Folklorists observed it and wrote down what they heard people talking about. And they did this in the 19th and 20th centuries.
We have folklorists earlier than that?
No, not really. There were people who studied ancient antiquities in England, for example. But among all of the ancient antiquities that were written down, they were proverbs and beliefs and superstitious. And I'm talking about people starting in the 1500s, already in the reign of Elizabeth. And there is not a single wise fairy tale recorded among their writings in that early period. But what I want to go back to is this sort of slippage when people say it is observed that people tell fairy tales like this orally. It's true. It is observed in the 19th and 20th centuries. It was not observed before that. So I think that saying that ordinary people were telling wise fairy tales in the 1500s or in the Middle Ages or in the late antiquity just doesn't hold water because we don't have the examples. Now, Dan has given some examples, but they are partial examples. For example, Aspasia, yes, Aspasia was ugly, and then she was made beautiful, and then she was carried off by Cyrus, and then she was handed on to another king, and then he died, and she was handed on to another one. So, and none of them did she marry. So it's not exactly a wise fairy tale.
Well, I just wanted to say to Dan, I mean, given the theory that fairy tales originated from oral storytelling, how difficult is it to substantiate this claim with evidence if it's all about oral storytelling and you didn't have a folklorist observing it?
Well, the argument reminds me of a particular joke, if I can say it for a few minutes. A person is looking for some money that he lost under the light during the night. And the passerby asking him, where did you lose the money? And he says, I lost the money in the dark. He says, so why are you looking here? He says, because here there is light. in the 20th century and in the starting with the 19th century, indeed, people began to pay attention to the oral narration that people are telling. But it does not mean that people did not tell stories before. And indeed, let's say some of the writers, classical writers, I'll just mention Petronius, who wrote the Satyricon, when he describes the telling of the widow of Ephesus, which is not a rise tale per se, but this is a classical folk tale, he describes it by describing a storytelling situation. People are sitting down and telling stories. Now, we don't have very often, say, these writers had to write their stories in a very shortened way and abbreviating them. So we don't have lengthy stories, and the rise tales, some of them exist and some of them were not recorded. You have also to realize that even in antiquities, many of these tales were considered light entertainment, that the people who recorded tales were more concerned with histories, with ethical narratives, with religious stories, and these tales went by the wayside.
So
we don't have their recordings.
But I wanted to say, Dan, that you've witnessed hostility to Ruth's ideas at folklore conferences.
I did witness hostility.
What sort of reaction has there been?
Well, the hostility was, and the concept of oral tradition and orality is fundamental to the discipline of folklore. And Ruth came to international meeting and bravely enough actually pounced us in the face, you know, and it hurt. And many folklorists, myself included, reacted to it.
But is that sounds like an emotional reaction? Are you? Is it an emotional reaction because somebody's challenging the basis of your academic study? I mean, isn't the free flow of ideas and swapping theories what you guys are supposed to be about?
Absolutely, and this is the reason Ruth and I argue strongly. Sometimes maybe there are some emotions, but we stay, I think, on the rational level, and in spite of the vigorous debate, we are still friends.
So, Ruth, how do you understand the resistance to your theory?
Well, as Dan says, my position does undermine one aspect of folkloric research. And a lot of people are emotionally committed to the idea of the folk. And after all, the idea that the folk generated tales that themselves formed sort of backbone for identifying a nation in the early 1800s in Germany, for instance. Germany was occupied by the French. Jacob and Wilhelm Grimm wanted nothing more than to be able to claim and prove that Germany was something more than a state of mind, that there was something real about it, that there was something that made it cohere. And so one of the first things they did was look for a common origins in stories that were told by a folk, a single German folk. Well, now, of course, there wasn't a single German folk in that period. But nonetheless, this was what they wanted, and in the rest of the 19th century, it was what other nations wanted as well. And out of that came a discipline of that based its methods on this idea of of the Fook as a generator.
Well, we're not going to be able to go on too long with this, but I just wanted to be clear. Dan, I mean, would you say in the last 30 seconds that most folklorists, most people who are studying this, wouldn't agree with Ruth?
Not in the 21st century. I'll take an issue with her explanation for the emotional upset. Modern folklorists do not consider folklore necessarily as a national heritage, but are considering and examine it as a performance of a verbal performance in society, and they diffuse any of the national feelings or interpretations that the Grimm brother invested in folklore. Today, I don't think that the national issue is at the core of the study of folklore.
All right, then. Look, I'm sure we're not going to work it out today on the book show, but thank you so much for joining me. Ruth Bottigheimer's book is called Fairy Tales, A New History. It's published by State University of New York Press. She teaches fairy tales at Stony Brook University in New York State. And Dan Ben-Amos is the chair of the Graduate Program in Folklore and Folklife and a professor in the Department of Near Eastern Languages and Civilizations at the University of Pennsylvania. His rebuttal to Ruth's ideas is in the next Journal of American Folklore. He's also currently editing the third volume of The Folk Tales of the Jews. This is The Book Show on ABC Radio National, and I'm your bookish fairy godmother, Ramona Koval.